This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be, the saying goes, unless, you know, you get a really good interest rate, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Khan Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 20th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the cost of money in this economy, interest rates in the vernacular. For the very best and most creditworthy borrowers, which is big Wall Street banks mostly, that cost, the federal funds rate is called, has been set by the Federal Reserve at 0 to 1/4 of 1%. So basically, free money. If the United States Treasury wants to borrow your money, that is, sell you, say, a 10-year Treasury note, they'll have to pay about 1.6% today. We'll get to that later in the program, as we always do. You, though, if you want to borrow maybe over 30 years for a fixed-rate mortgage, Freddie Mac said today it'll cost you just about 3%. You'll have to pay fees of a bit more than 0.5% on top of that. Ticking up, those rates are, but still incredibly low by historical standards for mortgages. And those low rates, which are, again, the cost of money, are tempting people to borrow more, and that, in turn, is driving up the average size of a mortgage in this economy, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Home prices are rising at the fastest pace in 15 years, partly because low interest rates are fueling demand for not enough houses.
That puts pressure on loan sizes because, you know, to purchase a home at a higher price, you're going to need to borrow more money.
Len Kiefer is an economist at Freddie Mac. The Mortgage Bankers Association said this week the average size of a purchase loan was $411,000, the highest since February, and the average loan for a new home reached more than $377,000 last month, a record high. The group's head of forecasting, Joel Kahn, says part of this is about the kinds of homes people are buying, you know, the bigger house in the suburbs with more outdoor space.
These homeowners typically are still, you know, gainfully employed, right? Might be higher income, et cetera. So they might be able to afford a little bit more.
To compete for those borrowers, lenders have been loosening credit standards. The MBA's Mortgage Credit Availability Index increased almost 5% last month for conventional loans and 7% for jumbo loans. Odetta Kushi is deputy chief economist at First American, a title insurance company.
That's really a function of the fact that our economy is improving, the labor market is improving, and so lenders are feeling a little bit more confident.
She says borrowers still need pretty pristine credit to qualify for a mortgage. Michael Neal with the Urban Institute says the risk of larger mortgages and looser standards is if prices suddenly drop.
For those that have just recently gotten a mortgage, you know, they've had less time to benefit from house price appreciation, increasing the likelihood that they'd be underwater.
Most analysts aren't expecting prices to fall anytime soon. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So here's a question. What do you think is the most trusted institution in American society today? Government? Nonprofits, maybe? The media? Don't answer that one. Thank you. The answer from a global survey by the public relations firm Edelman is business. And with that trust, it turns out, come expectations. Marketplace's Scott Tong has our story.
The survey finds that people think business outperforms government on a range of social issues: healthcare, inequality, jobs, climate change. Economist Margaret Blair, professor emerita at Vanderbilt Law, is not surprised, especially now.
We have a disillusionment with government to solve these kinds of problems, whereas business has actually done fairly well in getting us through the pandemic.
Blair sees a broader shift underway. 51 years ago, the free market economist Milton Friedman argued that the job of business was profits, not conscience. But the pendulum may be swinging back, in part because today's customers and employees demand it. So says Bill George, the former CEO of Medtronic.
A lot of the CEOs are still baby boomers, and I say, you know, you really need to be in personal touch with all your millennial employees. They want their CEO to have a position. In fact, they don't want to work there unless their company is clear on what it stands for.
But there is a risk that expectations are too high and that businesses still in Milton Friedman mode will underdeliver on social change. Here's historian Eric Loomis at the University of Rhode Island.
Corporations and business exist for one single reason, and that's profit. So unless it's in their profit interest to attack racism, to attack transphobia, to take leadership on vaccines, they're not going to want to do that.
In fact, today's survey warns against over-reliance on business as a savior. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oat milk was big. Seriously, it was. Major indices did all right, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Another 444,000 Americans filed first-time claims for unemployment last week. That is, as you have heard by now, a new low in this pandemic economy, but it is still way higher than it was in the before times. Way at the opposite end of the unemployment reality from those first-time claims is a group of people, millions of them, who fall broadly into a category that tells us a whole lot about where this economy stands right now and where it might be going.
Long-term unemployment.
That's Francine Blau at Cornell.
Those who've been unemployed for 27 weeks or more, that's about 6 months.
4.2 million Americans are in that category, long-term unemployed, which is a really tough place to be.
Their financial resources tend to run out. The psychological impact on their confidence and self-esteem is greater.
That's bad for the people affected, and it's bad for the economy, too.
The long-term unemployed may be more difficult to draw in back into the labor force.
They're often the last to get jobs, and there is some evidence that the longer you're unemployed, the less likely you are to even be interviewed for a job. So that's the practical effect of being long-term unemployed. But how come you got to be out of work for 6 months before you're in that high-risk category? Why not 3 months? Why not one? Why not a year? How did the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the people who define and collect data on unemployment, come up with 27 weeks in the first place?
How you define it is, in some sense, arbitrary.
We asked some other labor economists the same basic question, and they said the same basic thing that Francine Blau did. 6 months, it turns out, is just a nice round number. But the thing is, people start feeling the effects of long-term unemployment way before they hit that 27-week mark. So with that in mind, we went straight to the source.
I'm Patrick Carey, and I'm an assistant commissioner in the Office of Employment and Unemployment here at the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
The BLS has been collecting data on how many weeks people have been out of work going back to the 1940s.
The breakout of 27 or more weeks accords well with the maximum length of time that many states offer regular unemployment insurance benefits.
Makes sense, right? When your benefits run out, you're kind of in a new stage of being out of work, one with not much support. But that 27 weeks number only became the official marker for long-term unemployment in 1994.
Previously, the term was used for those jobless for 15 or more weeks. And at that time, the 27 weeks or more category was described as very long-term unemployment.
The BLS dropped the very after the recession that started in 1990. It wasn't especially deep, that recession, but the job market took a good long while to come back.
Its aftermath was associated with slower than usual improvement in the unemployed 27 weeks or more category.
And that gets us to the Great Recession, 2008. 2009, really deep and really long, and long-term unemployment hit record highs. Almost half of the people who were out of work in April of 2010 had been looking for a job for more than 6 months. By June of 2015, that is 5 years later, still more than 25% of the people who were looking for work were in that long-term unemployed category. And that forced the BLS to change its definitions again.
In January 2011, the current population survey was modified to allow respondents to report longer durations of unemployment.
Before the Great Recession, the longest you could report you'd been out of work was 2 years. After, five, said the BLS.
Part of the motivation here was the unprecedented rise in the number of persons with very long durations of unemployment.
The thing about this recession, not the overall economy, because that's bouncing back, but the pandemic labor market part of the recession, is that the rules have kind of gone out the window. Businesses have closed, others have opened, people are still scared, kids need to be taken care of, the unknown unknowns are pretty high. So we'll keep an eye on the long-term unemployed, and maybe there will be another change in what that phrase actually means. All right, let's go to healthcare now. A new research today from the Commonwealth Fund and George Washington University that says if the 14 states that have still not expanded Medicaid as the Affordable Care Act allowed them to do, with the federal government picking up almost all of the tab, if those 14 states that haven't expanded it did, more than a million new jobs could be created in 2022. The latest relief bill, you might remember, that was signed in March, offered those holdout states extra incentives to expand their coverage. Medicaid, of course, providing health coverage for low-income Americans. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looked at one state that did expand eligibility and then what happened with its job numbers.
Michigan expanded Medicaid in 2014, and University of Michigan economists were watching closely. They say the Medicaid expansion led to the creation of more than 30,000 jobs in the state. University of Michigan health economist Helen Levy says more than a third of the jobs were in healthcare, but the others were in retail or construction.
Not all the spending stays in healthcare. Some of it spills over.
Levy says, look at the University of Michigan hospital. It would need to hire more workers to help with the new patients from the Medicaid expansion. And those workers would go out and spend money, say at Angelo's, a sandwich shop next to the hospital.
More people are going to be making more money, and they're going to stop at Angelo's for lunch.
Now, Levy's predictions are based on economic models, which not everyone agrees with. Charles Blahaus is a senior research strategist at George Mason University. He says, sure, Medicaid expansion would create healthcare jobs.
We would expect that to happen, right? I would say the second question of whether it leads to an increase in jobs in general is unknown.
Leighton Koo, a co-author on the Commonwealth study on Medicaid expansion, says these job creation models aren't an exact science, but they still paint an accurate picture of the impact of job creation from Medicaid expansion.
It provides these states a shot in the arm at a point when they're trying to recover from the COVID pandemic.
In fact, Koo says if the holdout states did expand Medicaid, they'd get $49 billion from the federal government in 2022. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
If you need a head start on business and economic news, might I recommend my colleague David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your economic day. Check it out. Coming up.
Companies are so inherently competitive.
I know. Tell me about it. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 188 points today, about a half percent, 34,084. The NASDAQ jumped 236, 1.7%, 13,535. The S&P 500 up 43 points, 1%, 41.59. $700 billion, that is how much the Treasury Department hopes to bring in from tax cheats over the next decade under a plan released today. The plan would increase the IRS's budget to make up for cuts that have eroded the agency's ability to go after tax cheats, require financial institutions to provide more information to the tax man, especially about wealthy Americans, upgrade some computer systems as well, and tighten regulations of paid tax preparers. In stock news, Hormel Foods reported higher earnings and revenues for the last quarter. Shares closed up 7.3%. Shares in Oatly, the oat milk company, up 19% on its IPO day today. Ticker symbol, by the way, which doesn't quite work, OTLY. I don't know, spelling matters, you guys. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Supply chains and shipping delays are right at the top of the list of big stories about this economy, especially in the last week or 10 days, with the pipeline shutdown in the southeast and a major bridge over the Mississippi River being shut down because it's fallen apart. So we have gotten Austin Golding on the phone to discuss. He is in the shipping business running Golding Barge Line in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Hey, Austin, good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, Kai.
All right, so look, I'm going to skip the typical first question of how's business because I can only imagine it has been like a week and a half for you with the pipeline shut down and with the bridge up near Memphis. Must have been a mess for a guy running a barge company.
It was a busy week, which was a real change from where we've been, you know, since the pandemic started. I tell you, though, you know, boats and barges typically come in whenever there is an upset, like a hurricane or a pipeline outage. So we were happy to be there to answer the call.
Yeah, I imagine you guys are a force multiplier in times like that. What was it like? I mean, when the pipeline shut down and when the bridge shut down, what happened at you know, Golding Barge Line's HQ?
Well, when the pipeline shut down, our phone lines lit up. So we were either helping the containment issue on the Gulf Coast or helping actually get finished product to the consumer on the Nashville market and up into the Ohio River Basin.
Yeah, and the bridge closure, you can do, you know, river traffic underneath. The bridge is still closed. But, you know, even river traffic was closed for a while.
Oh, as soon as we got barges loaded, ready to head north, the first boat out of the area got shut down with the bridge closure. It was just one thing after another. And I'm really hopeful that whatever game plan they have with that bridge doesn't cause another closure down the road, because it cut the country in half. It absolutely shut the river down. And in a matter of hours, we had hundreds of barges with all kinds of commodities stacked up on either side of it. It was probably a true example of how we're way overdue for an infrastructure package in this country.
Let's talk about things improving. I don't know how bad it got in your worst days at the company, but do you think you're out of the woods? You're going to make it through now for sure?
I think we're out of the woods from a survival standpoint, but we are a long way from out of the woods when it comes to reinstating everything that we like to do here, meaning raises in the short term, full benefit packages being reinstated, being able to do all of our maintenance that we want to do. So we're past survival mode, but now we need to start putting some of these creature comforts back into our cost structure. And that'll happen, I hope, between now and the end of the year.
Talk to me about labor for a second. I'm sure you pay attention to the job market and unemployment reports. What's it like for you as you're trying to get deckhands and pilots and all of those things?
Well, it's extremely difficult. I think with unemployment plus and a lot of the stimulus that's come out, people are on the sidelines. I know there's a lot of debate about how much of an impact that's had.
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you that I was on a bunch of congressional calls this week with several of my contemporaries from across the country, and we were all singing the same tune. You know, mixed between anxiety about going back to work and having an option not to, I really try to keep a level head and not overreact to the fact that our applications are way down, because I know once everything gets back to normal, we'll probably return to the same pace of applicant. At least that's my hope.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go, and a little bit, you know, peek behind the curtain. We had to slide our interview a little bit because you were out doing a business meeting, I guess. What's it like out there doing business meetings in person?
Well, I'm fully vaccinated, and we are big time pro-vaccine. And once I put out there that we're fully vaccinated and we're complying with everything that the CDC and that the powers that be have suggested, we have had a lot of people, I think, be starved for a meeting. I think everybody's pretty much Zoomed and Teamed to death. And if we're going to do volume business like we do, they want to look you in the eye and know who they're doing business with person to person. So I've been happy to get back out on the road. And yeah, I was actually out meeting with clients, you know, at lunch at a restaurant, fully vaccinated. So we're doing our part for sure and promoting that as the healthy way to go about doing business at this point.
There you go. Austin Golding, he runs Golding Barge Lines down in Vicksburg, Mississippi, the family business. Austin, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon. Stay safe.
Thank you, Kyle. All my best.
The fact that China and the United States compete against each other is ground well trod. Competition that gets confrontational in some cases. Trade and tariffs, islands in the South China Sea, human rights, Mars, too. We've both got rovers up there now, although we've got a helicopter, too. There is another thing to add to the list. Standards, technological standards, the rules that companies pretty much everywhere follow so that their devices and their gizmos can work together, but also compete together. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is on the technology beat today.
If I have an iPhone and I call a Samsung phone, I can talk. If I take my phone to Brazil or Singapore or France, it'll still call and it'll still text. That's not some kind of global coincidence.
Technical standards ensure that you can use your device pretty much anywhere around the world and it'll work.
Standards. Naomi Wilson is vice president with ITI, a trade association representing around 80 of the world's major tech companies. From HDMI cables to complex 5G cell phone connections, if something's going to work around the world, then the world has to be on the same page. The way these standards are decided is mostly by the companies themselves through different organizations like Wilson's.
Companies are so inherently competitive, the notion that they would also cooperate and build consensus can seem a bit ironic.
But that's what they do. It helps them reach more consumers. So literally, the companies get together at meetings, debate different tech standards, and vote on what the standard should be. And if the standards that everyone likes happen to be the ones based on technology you patented, well, that is pretty great for you.
A good example would be your cell phone.
James Lewis is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
In the 3G cell phones, European companies came up with the standards. And it was a huge boon to those companies, an immense source of wealth.
Nokia and Qualcomm, for example, earn billions per year in royalties because competitors use standards they came up with. And here is where the controversy starts.
The Chinese realized the values of standards and decided to capture them.
China's government started to increase Chinese participation in these global standards organizations.
They flood the meetings. There might be five Chinese experts for every non-Chinese expert.
The voting isn't usually one person, one vote, so that doesn't in and of itself guarantee Chinese standards will beat out others. But Lewis says China's also tried to move standard setting to government bodies at the UN, where it has more influence, and at times has politicized the decision-making process. Adam Siegel is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
There's been some instances where Chinese firms seem to be giving in to pressure from the Chinese government and the Chinese public to support Chinese standards, even if they thought other standards were the better ones.
For some, China's assertiveness on standards represents an economic and security threat. Officials from the U.S. to Germany to Japan have been suspicious of China's intentions, concerned Chinese standards might support its state security apparatus. For others,
it is normal that the Chinese companies would want to be in this space.
In response to U.S. pressure, some standard-setting organizations have kicked out some Chinese firms. That's pushed some Chinese companies to create separate Chinese tech standards.
What industry does not want is China staying home and creating its own brand of China-unique standards.
That is U.S. policy backfiring in action, says Wilson at ITI.
That causes a myriad of problems in terms of foreign companies that are required to adopt Chinese standards in order to get into the market, are at an inherent disadvantage.
Another unintended consequence of U.S.-China policy has come from the blacklisting of several Chinese tech firms, leaving U.S. companies wondering if they can actually set tech standards together.
Companies still remain unsure about whether they can or cannot fully participate in these global standards discussions.
That's Patrick Lozada, Director of Global Policy at the Telecommunications Industry Association, a standard-setting organization. If the U.S. is concerned about Chinese participation in standard setting, there's a simple solution, says Melissa Newman, a VP with TIA.
Increase U.S. participation in standards development.
The government could fund or incentivize companies of all sizes to engage more. As the saying goes, if you aren't at the table, you're on the menu. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, one delves with reluctance into global tax policy, but put this one in your back pocket for when it inevitably comes around again. This afternoon, the Biden administration proposed a global minimum corporate tax rate of 15%. Stephen Beard did a story for us last week, you might remember, about the global implications of that. Ireland, he pointed out, taxes companies at 12.5%. The lesson there is incentives matter. Currently, domestically, American companies pay 21%. Not over, this discussion is, by a long shot. All right, we're going, but here is your moment of economic context. The rest of the story on those first-time jobless claims I mentioned earlier. Low as that number was, relatively speaking, against the beginning of the pandemic, context requires that I point out that overall, as of the 1st of May, there were still 15.9 million people in this economy getting some kind of government unemployment assistance. The good news on that is that a year ago, it was 21 million people. So progress. Slow, but progress. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.